Okay, we're recording now. It's Saturday, September 13th, at around 9 o'clock in the morning Central Time. This is Julie and JP today. We're over here on our Book of Hours platform. And
probably a table talk, right?
Yeah, another table talk. We used to do these a lot, but lately JP's been really busy working. But this morning, I asked him if he wouldn't mind sharing some of his thoughts around sort of the fallout of what happened after September 10th. So the first thing I want to do is I want to jump right into it, and I want to read what apparently Charlie Kirk's wife said at this eulogy that she gave.
Right,
this,
which was looked like it was an empty audience. I mean, it was just just a eulogy to the world via video.
It was a eulogy to users. There wasn't anybody in the room. It's kind of like when Greta Thunberg, you know, said, "How dare you?"
Right.
You know,
to an empty audience.
To an empty audience.
Right.
But as long as it trended, that's all that matters.
Right.
So,
and the way that they edited that video and curated it, it made it look like she was speaking to, because they placed video of the billionaires that she was allegedly talking to in an audience, and they showed shots of them in a crowded auditorium, and then they cut to her.
Right.
This is different than that.
Yeah.
But that was just such manipulation, right?
Right.
And
well,
propaganda.
That's the whole point of this.
Right. And this is equally propagandistic.
And equally manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
So, quote, "The cries of this widow will echo around the world like a battle cry. Quote, the movement's not going anywhere, and it will only go stronger once you join in. Quote, I'll make Turning Point USA the biggest thing this nation has ever seen, I promise. Quote, doing what you always wanted to do, making heaven crowded, that's what it's all about." This is Erica Kirk, Friday, September 12th, 2025.
Making heaven crowded.
I don't know. It's a Christian thing.
I know, but that entails killing people.
Well, so this, wow, that's interesting. So, but making heaven crowded.
Right.
So,
no, I know.
So one thing I've...
Killing good
before
people.
Before you go on and talk about your very salient point about what this really is, like the motives and stuff, just let me insert a little intel about the born again Christian
community
and their attitude. Every born again Christian is super excited to get to heaven. They can't wait to get to heaven, which I always found a little morbid and a little macabre. So anyway, so I think that's what she's talking about. I thought she was Catholic, so there seems to be a lot of, you know,
there's some weirdness going on.
Definitely some weirdness going on there. Is she Catholic? Is she born again Christian? Because you can't get two more opposite religions than that. So.
Or sects of a religion, because they're both Christian. But the thing is, the born agains don't consider the Catholics Christian. That's always fun,
right? And the Catholics probably don't even acknowledge the born agains.
I know, I never did when I was, you know, practicing Catholic.
Right. Okay, so what's your opinion of what she said about going to make Turning Point USA the biggest thing?
Right, so we were talking about earlier, we were talking about how it felt like, you know, she's kind of like going along with it or was in on it, right? Because we watched a video of her. There's lots of weird videos coming out of her.
Right.
And I think we have to talk about that before we get into this, but let me just say, I was trying to figure out what was in it for her to go along with all this weird imagery and signals coming out with her in them. And when she said, "I'm going to make Turning Point into," what was it, the exact quote? I don't remember, I'm sorry.
I'll make Turning Point USA the biggest thing this nation has ever seen.
Right. So she's basically saying she's got a career for life. And if she went along, you know, we assert still to this day that he was killed by the state, but specifically by a faction of the state, which is, you know, what people would call maybe the deep state, which is the influencers, you know, behind the scenes. And we're talking about Thiel, right?
Mm-hmm. and a whole bunch of other, you know,
sure.
bad actors
yeah.
that have something to gain
right.
through this.
Right. So something to gain. Right.
Assassination.
Right. So that, thank you, because that dovetails into what I was thinking when mm-hmm. I heard her say that on that video that you just, you know, you read the transcript to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that they basically said, if you go along, they may not have even approached her before the killing.
Right.
They probably did it afterwards, but I don't know. I'm not going to
I have a thought about what you're going to say, okay. but go on.
Okay. So if you go along with us, we will make sure that you will take over Turning Point, that you will benefit from, you know, a lifetime career, that you will be able to, you know, make lots of money and be, you know, comfortable for the rest of your life as long as you do what we tell you to, and or even ask of you, whatever the case may be, okay? Now, here's the thing. The reason that the apparatus that I like to call it, you call it the powers that be, I call it the apparatus, because I don't like using the term deep state and all that. It just sounds too conspiratorial, even though the apparatus does too. But it feels to me more accurate. The apparatus gains a lot from shutting up Charlie by killing him and having his legacy live on in something that they can manipulate.
Yeah, that's usually how it is.
Mm-hmm. So basically, kind of a long dove, it kind of like fits in with like what you were talking about yesterday. It's like he was saying things that they can't let him continue saying, right? And so if you can continue the energy and the name, the movement in name only, but directed a little less toward, you know, because you also mentioned this. I mean, he was very Christ-like in his messaging,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I didn't agree with a lot of things that he said, but
yeah.
the core of what he was talking about was that, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, jailing the poor for being poor or whatever. I don't know if he said that outright, but it felt like that was sort of his,
yeah.
you know.
He was concerned about all the things that, you know, that all of us are concerned about,
right.
no matter what side
yeah.
of the aisle you sit on.
Right. Now,
on.
You know, now he put too much faith, in my opinion, in the Constitution, but that was him. So I'm not going to criticize him for that.
Yeah.
That's so my opinion.
Just because, you know, we're of the, we, our position is that you don't need a piece of paper to,
tell
written by
free.
A bunch of wealthy men who mm-hmm. used you for an agenda back at the, you know, the founding of the country. You don't need a piece of paper written by them to tell you that you're free. You know, you're a human being. You have, just by being a human means that you have freedom of movement, freedom of thought, freedom of speech.
Yeah.
You know,
and
but you also have the freedom to make mistakes. You mm-hmm. also have the freedom to, you know, open yourself up to situations that you may have accidentally stumbled into and not realized, you know, that you shouldn't have gone there. But you can always, you have the freedom to get out of those,
mm-hmm.
you know.
To correct things.
You have the freedom to self-correct.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole situation is about control.
Mm-hmm.
It's about making the population forget that they have the freedom
mm-hmm.
to self-correct, as opposed to some sort of parent state or authoritarian figure in your life that is going to do the correcting for you.
Right.
We're not children.
Correct.
You know,
yeah.
Children don't even need to be corrected. Children don't need punishment.
They need guidance.
They simply need guidance. That's all. You know, And I don't know, this feels, I recently tweeted, I said, okay, I'm done. There's a little too much necromancy going on this platform.
Right.
Peace out for a few days. Like, I'm like, it's feeling a little bit weird. And so in response to what you said about how the the apparatus went to her and said, "You'll be set for life." Mm-hmm. I think it was probably said in something more, it was said exactly that way, but probably something in this kind of language, like, "Erica, we're so deeply, deeply sorry for your loss and this terrible, terrible tragedy. We want you to know that your family will be okay. You know, mm-hmm. you will be fine and they will be fine. We'll make sure of it. This cannot go, you know, this turning point isn't going to go anywhere. Turning point is going to continue on. And we'd like it if you could be a part of the movement so that this legacy and your husband's legacy doesn't die." It was probably said in a more like...
corporate way.
Well, not even corporate, like, but more in a... Because you were saying, if you do these things, then this can be done for you. Yeah, and that's very corporate. That's like, here, sign here on this memo
I was coming at it from a very, like, just to illustrate in a very black and white way.
Business-like way. Whereas I think it was probably somebody, like the board probably, like, drew straws. Like, okay, who's going to be the one to send the message? And they probably took a look.
They had their PR person put something together.
No. What I'm saying is, who's going to be the one to sit down with Erica? Right. Is it going to be some, you know, hard-ass businessman? Or is it going to be some soccer mom who's going to be a little bit more compassionate towards her? You know what I'm saying? So I don't think it was like, here, sign this piece of paper.
I didn't think it was that either. I mean, the way you're describing it, it's, you know, I think that it's correct in both ways. I think that, you know, the language, the flowery language that you're describing
was probably used over breakfast.
Right, and it was,
you know.
Right, and it was used at a time when she was most vulnerable
and
it was, you know, but it was still done by a hard hard as rock PR person.
Right, and it's an agenda-driven message because the best, knowing this from personal experience with the situation that I've discovered regarding my grandmother, when a person is at their most vulnerable is when you can manipulate them the most and convince them the most. So, you know, and the same thing even happened, you mentioned, to your grandmother after her husband died. All of a sudden, these vultures came out of nowhere to take advantage of her, which is exactly what happened to my grandmother when her son, my father, died. Vultures came out of nowhere to take advantage of her. So... that's all I'm saying, is that, and in order to really convince someone that this is the way to go, you got to get them when they're at their most vulnerable, and then you have to softly, you know, etch this idea into their consciousness and into their mind. I think that there may have been a little manipulation of Erica going on, but I also think that she's enough of a narcissist and enough of a... you know, that she had her own agenda and her own idea about, you know, the being a powerful, influential person, that it was easy to manipulate her, you know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I tweeted also the comparison of the beloved BT, Brian Thompson, you know, the vice president who was allegedly gunned down, you know, right before, Optum and United Healthcare went on their firing spree.
Yeah,
right?
In fact, they were going to, from what I understand, they were going to start laying people off right before the holidays, and the BT thing happened, and so one hand was not talking to the other.
Right, exactly.
So
they couldn't necessarily fire thousands of employees when morale was so low after the assassination beloved vice president.
And when they needed people to chime in and berate the media for what they were saying about the situation.
Right.
Because so I was reading some of the comments in the internal whatever it was, Teams or whatever it was.
Yeah, the internal messaging that was going on with employees after his assassination, the story of his assassination. Right,
so there was, you know, like it used to be Yammer, I forget what it's called now, but it's, you know, this part of this, you know, Microsoft suite that everybody, you know, corporations have. And
internally,
right. So it was sort of like an internal, you know, social media. And, and, you know, the company was trying to message this thing in a certain way. And there were people who were just like falling all over themselves to repeat the talking points.
Sure. But there were enough employees that were like,
mm. Yeah, there were. There were.
They were pushing back against the talking points.
Yeah, they were talking about how UHC,
United Health Group.
Yeah, but it's also United Health Corporation. So they have both names, you know, but yeah, UHG would like deny health insurance to people who were like on death's door in the hospital and like needed an emergency, you know, whatever for their heart or something. And they would get denied.
Yeah.
That, you know, they didn't get a second opinion or they didn't have enough proof and evidence or they didn't have enough whatever, right?
I wonder if those employees who pushed back against the corporate narrative about how BT and the company was so great, if they got fired. Because they were on a public forum internally.
Right, yeah. I'm surprised they said what they said. I was really surprised. I didn't say a damn thing.
You were like an armchair anthropologist like I am, just scrolling through the comments going, wow, okay, you're fired. You might be fired.
You are so fired. Yeah. Well, it didn't matter because, you know, a month later they started laying people off with abandon.
Right. And just chopping.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I wouldn't doubt that some
sycophants got let go, as well as people who were critical. So
exactly.
It doesn't matter.
So the whole point of bringing up the Brian Thompson, or otherwise known as the beloved BT in the inner circles, is one, I think his name is Phil Helmsley. He's the guy that took over.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you have to understand the background of the Brian Thompson, Phil Helmsley, and Andrew Witty.
Mm-hmm. Sir Andrew Witty.
These three individuals were, you know, under scrutiny by the federal government for all sorts of infractions. Mm-hmm. They were maneuvering through various lawsuits. Various companies were...
All three were named.
And all three of them were named. Then right after BT was killed, Witty stepped down and Phil Helmsley... And his name is Helmsley, and he took the helm.
Right. I know.
And if you look at this guy, he just has the look of like a demon with skin draped over
him. He's fucking Mr. Burns.
He is horrible. So there's no doubt in my mind that they took their own out because they got tired of the controversy and the lawsuits.
And he was vulnerable.
Very vulnerable.
He was more vulnerable than they were in these lawsuits, I
right.
think.
Right, the more most vulnerable. Yeah. And he agreed on the side to make a statement. You know, he's like, hey, look, I'll just quit and get a good severance and, you know, and just disappear off into the shadows.
They sure did.
And instead, they killed him off, gave his wife a good severance, his family a good severance. And the whole thing about this is that one... Mangione, just like the guy that they captured Charlie Kirk, and also with JFK, Lee Harvey Oswald, Mangione was just a patsy, just a persona.
Yeah, he wasn't a real person.
BT probably was poisoned. I think that he was probably poisoned internally, died of, you know, internal injuries or some kind of event.
And then what we saw was just a mock-up. Yeah.
And,
it was stagecraft.
And it was stagecraft. And it wasn't even real. And it was like a recording of a recording of a recording off of a fuzzy security camera. So it was really easy to break it down and go, based on the fact that, you know, that they had all these lawsuits, based on the fact that the economy is tanking and all these people are about ready to lose their jobs, and based on the fact that there's all this controversy and good old Phil, Mr. Burns of the operation, is going to, you know, walk away scot-free.
Right.
It was easy to sort of come to the conclusion that it was an inside job, right?
Mm-hmm.
With BT or Brian Thompson. the response from his widow, which was his ex-wife, mm-hmm. and his children was appropriate in that there was no response.
Right.
I fully expected Erica King to work to go and grieve privately, work on Turning Point USA privately, take care of herself and her children. Mm-hmm. Because this whole time that she's out there in front, you know, caressing cadavers and making announcements in front of podiums.
We'll get into that in a minute.
Oh, yeah. And making announcements in front of podiums, I'm like, I keep thinking to myself, I mean, if she's a Catholic, there's a certain, like, ritual that you partake in where you kind of shut yourself off from the public, you surround yourself with your children and your close, close family. I assumed that she would be with her family, mm-hmm. Taking care of her children, and maybe even going away to some other house that's not hers and grieving, while at the same time probably, you know, having some team meetings and stuff regarding Turning Point USA. Okay, yes, I'll sign here, I'll do this. But that's private, mm-hmm. you know? Taking care of business, but also taking care of, you know, the appropriate mourning rituals, you know?
That's not necessarily a Catholic thing either. I mean, you know.
I know, that just seems like a thing that people would do, but instead she's, you know, it's different, and which then makes the whole assassination itself kind of even a little more sus, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, you know, it's the actions of an influencer, right?
Right. That's true. I mean, that's really just putting it bluntly, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, you know, let's just cut the shit. Let's just, like, go to the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
She, you know, she's acting like an influencer in all this.
Yeah,
that,
she is.
That statement, and you can find the video out there, Julie read the transcript from it. It's like, why at a podium? Like, I'm looking at all the signals, right?
Right, right.
And it was all really staged. I mean, there was soft lighting in the background, and it was at his desk, and his objects were around, his personal items were on the desk. And yeah.
Oh.
That was his desk.
Oh, I missed that part. Wow.
I mean, you know, I don't have to be told that was his stuff, cuz right. that's what they were doing. Those are the symbols of his life.
Oh, weird.
And yeah, okay. Okay, and that's why it was held in that room. But why was it at a podium? Why didn't she sit down? Why didn't, you know, why wasn't, well, they had to show you the desk and the room.
Mhm.
And it had to be formal like that because, who knows? I think it was more because you could get all those things in the shot that you couldn't get into a shot of her sitting down.
That's
because
true.
If you're sitting down, you're going to go more for the portrait framing of the individual. Because remember going back to, I can't think of her name. She's married to the Prince of Wales.
Kate Middleton.
Remember the statement she made that was, who knows whether it was her or AI or not? But like the...
Oh,
the,
you mean about how she had pre-cancer?
Yeah. And the framing of that, she was sitting, and it was a very tight shot. There wasn't a lot in the background that you could pick out other than like nature, right? A natural setting.
Right.
Okay. That's generally how you do those kinds of, you know, statements.
Yeah.
Right? Even like when the president gives a speech or a press conference,
mm-hmm.
it's always a talking head shot.
Right.
Right? It's not about the background. It's about the person talking. This was different. It was about the background.
Interesting.
As much as it was about what she was saying.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. Everybody curates their messages and wants to get...
I think that message was curated for her.
Right.
I think that was deliberately set up that way.
Kind of like...
The new handlers.
So, by the new handlers, exactly. I'm going to stand in front of Charlie's desk and in his office, and all of his things are going to be around because I have now replaced him.
Mm-hmm.
I am Charlie now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the message.
That's the message.
Whether it was external handlers or the internal organization,
mm-hmm.
I believe that it was these were choices that were made deliberately.
Right. So those were choices that were made deliberately post-assassination. Do you think that this was a decision that was made prior to his killing and that they needed to work with the powers that be, the deep state, or the apparatus in order to fulfill that messaging?
No.
Or it's just a response to the assassination?
Yeah, I can't say.
After the fact.
I can't say. But what I will say is that whether it was influenced by the outside, meaning the apparatus, or it was internally decided, it was post-death. It was post-mortem. It was not done beforehand.
Right. So, talk about memento mori.
Okay, so when...
It means the memory of death.
Right, yeah.
Okay, memento mori.
A memento of a death.
Right.
So, earlier this morning, you were showing me this video. You're like, there's some weird stuff coming out, some really weird shit coming out. And you showed me this video of her caressing, so her hand caressing the dead hand, what?
Okay, it actually literally translates as, "Remember, you will die."
Oh, interesting.
Wow, that's so, like, creepy. Okay, go on.
Yeah, that's really creepy. Well, it's very old world, right?
Yeah,
okay,
it is.
So, Latin. Mm-hmm. That's a direct translation of Latin, too. So mm-hmm. like we have to, that's a direct translation as opposed to a contextual translation
right.
as well.
Right, okay.
Okay, so...
caressing his hand.
His hand, his waxy, corpsey hand. And even like, and this is at his coffin, so his open coffin, and she's like caressing his hand, and then she even leans down and like kisses it, and at one point she kind of like embraces the body, and okay, I understand she's grieving, but this was very self-conscious, along with like that other video that we were just talking about, her at the podium. It felt very self-conscious
mm-hmm.
and staged,
mm-hmm.
not an authentic display of emotion.
Right.
It felt really inauthentic. So as you were showing this to me, I was like, I said it out loud, this feels so Victorian.
Mm-hmm.
And and I think you were a little confused by that. So I was like, okay. Or you weren't sure what I meant by that. You didn't say anything.
I was processing it.
Yeah, yeah.
I was processing it because...
Like, what does that mean?
Because I immediately went back to the Victorian era. And I immediately started thinking about, movies or things I've read. Mm-hmm. And I immediately went into like a Dickensian realm. Where there was so much poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, poverty, death, please may I have more, sir. Like, when
that
you said Victorian,
shit.
That's where I went.
That's
I went to
went.
Dickens.
Right,
you
okay,
know?
Cool.
So that's probably why if I had a confused look on my face, because when people say Victorian, I immediately
go
to
there.
Dickens.
Yeah, well,
right.
Dickens, through his fiction, he was able to accurately depict that era, right?
Right.
But... This was, so what I was referring to was in the Victorian era, and it started around the 1850s, okay, there were a lot of childhood deaths going on. And I don't have to go into why that is right now.
I think it's important.
Okay, so the reason
touch
why...
Touch on it.
Okay, so this is another little branch. The reason why a lot of children were dying at the time was that we were in the throes of the Industrial Revolution.
The first
Industrial Revolution, and there was a lot of toxicity in the air, and a lot of they blamed it on disease and crowding of cities and things like that. Well, disease happens as a result of
poisons
and toxins and things like that. So children were dying from all the toxicity in the air, and people were dying too, but the children were more vulnerable. And, children were, even if they were rural, I mean, they were still dying. But this was more of an urban thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it dovetailed with the time of photography becoming more accessible to ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And so they would have these portraits taken of their children, but they weren't just like, you know, like a shot of the child in the coffin. It was like this staged kind of photo as if they were, you know, sleeping. They would be propped up and in their best gown or dress, you know, clothing, whatever, their Sunday best, whatever. Yeah. And they would look like they were, you know, sitting there, or they would be all, if they were in the coffin, the family would be surrounding the coffin. Mm-hmm. And they called it memento mori, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they called that sort of type of photography after a while. They labeled mm-hmm. it, because we always have to label things, right? Mm-hmm. And so the other thing about this is that these were like tintypes, or they weren't just pieces of paper like we get now, like on photo, or what we used to get. Now everything's digital. Right. But what we used to get out of the camera or the, you know, pick up from the Kodak, you know, like kiosk, were prints. Mm-hmm. This wasn't a print on a piece of paper. This was a print on either tin or glass or whatever.
Daguerreotype.
So it might have been a daguerreotype. It might have been a tin type, okay, which was on tin.
Sure.
I think daguerreotypes were on glass. Mm-hmm. And it would be in a little like compact case.
Like
right.
a small, like a little, yeah. little almost like a locket, but a little bit bigger than
right.
a
locket. So it would be probably a little bigger than the size of a business card.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe 4 by, you know, or maybe 5 by 3.
Okay.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you could close it. You could mm-hmm. keep it open, or, you know, and set it up on a mantle.
Or you could close it and tuck it away in mm-hmm. a drawer.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
They could also take the image out and put it into a, you know, a book, mm-hmm. like an album.
Sure.
But this was a way of remembering the child and remembering that life.
Yeah.
And
it's so the idea of, you know, I guess, I don't know.
But the reason that it reminded me of that, it was very staged.
Yeah.
Very deliberate.
Just like in Memento Mori in the mid-1800s.
Right. It was very staged.
And very deliberate.
Right. The whole point of it was to, you know, record the death of a child, or this child, you know.
I feel like, I feel like I recall seeing or hearing of some memento memories where the children would be, their corpses, mm-hmm. their cadavers, would be dressed up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and put in positions of the things that they liked to do the
yeah.
most, like mm. putting him on a tricycle or putting her in a rocking chair, holding her doll, you know.
That might have been the case.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
I feel like for some reason I just got a flash of that. Like, that's so, anyway.
Yeah. You know, that might have gone on. I don't know if I've seen examples of that. I've mostly seen the bodies just propped up.
Just propped up in chairs.
Mm-hmm. With surrounded, like, you know, like there was like velvet behind them.
Sure, yeah.
So that would probably be in the studio. But sometimes the photographers would go out to the family home, and that's where you'd see the coffin.
Right.
With the family surrounding the coffin in the family home, you know.
So you're right. I mean, those, the image of her, this video of her caressing his hand and kissing his hand and, you know, being all intimate, it was like necromancy.
It was weird like that.
It was. There is a certain element of necromancy in Memento Mori. Like, we're going to love this dead person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're going to love the, and it, I think what it is it, it's kind of, it's a little over the top.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is a time where you have to love the memory of someone and you have to grieve privately and process your feelings around what's happening. But to make a display, whether it's through, you know, a mid-19th century photo or whether it's a 21st century video caressing the hands, I mean, there is a certain, you know, point where you have to go, okay, this is a little weird.
Well, I think there's also a broader context that connects the two. And the one is that in, you know, the Victorian photos, this was a new phenomenon. This was something that was unheard of before.
Well, and a lot of people are saying the same thing about the assassination itself, mm-hmm. and also her response to it. We've never seen anything like
right.
this.
So it was a cultural response, or not a cultural response. It was a human response, but it was done. It was such an en masse phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
right? That it became a thing. Now, the connection I'm seeing is that, like, this is a very unusual death, right? Everybody's talking about, yeah, we've seen assassinations of, you know, politicians, but this guy wasn't a politician.
Mm-hmm.
He was an influencer, and he was a guy that basically was on a speaking tour.
And he was a moderate.
And he was a moderate. There was no reason for him to be murdered.
He wasn't radical.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd see videos of you know, these hair on fire children in universities who, you know, been, you know, whatever, brainwashed with whatever, you know, postmodernist, you know, theory. Mm-hmm. Or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. being spewed at them, and them, like, you know, in you know, just taking it in like whole cloth, mm-hmm. and like being able to spit out like what things, you know, like phrases and things that were, you know, what things meant that you've never heard of in real life, and mm-hmm. that don't matter in real life.
No,
right?
No. Yeah.
So you see these reactions to these students who have been, you know, indoctrinated on one hand, and then encounter somebody who has more of a, you know, an everyday mm-hmm. approach to language and, mm-hmm. and ideas.
Right.
And these weird encounters between that, you know, that's about the only controversy that ever was. I remember looking at, you know, like Facebook pages of, you know, more radical groups. And he was always featured on these things because he'd have the table that says "Prove me wrong," right?
Right.
You know, and there was all these videos and stuff on Facebook, and he was always painted as kind of, well, he was never painted as a villain, but he was always kind of painted as kind of a, like, a dick.
Right.
Right.
Just someone who was, you know, this annoying individual.
Right.
So to lift him up, you know, after his death, to lift him up like he was this really radical person, first of all, that's false, because that's mm-hmm. not how he was.
No.
He was a moderate,
yeah.
and he was very simple and plain in his message. You know, I just want to worship how I want to worship, and I just want to make sure that, you know, Americans have a good life, and then mm-hmm. everybody gets a seat at the table. There are plenty of even trans and detransed people and current people that are still, you know, trans, and I don't know if they'll ever detransition, but... that have come out on Twitter and have basically said he was very nice to us.
Mm-hmm.
We had interactions with him and he was great. So, you know, you've got headlines that are saying he hated trans people and called for their death. And mm-hmm. the trans people are like, that's not true.
Right.
That's not true at all.
He never did that. You know.
And also you had Stephen King come out and say something and then retracted it, removed his tweet, and apologized for the tweet. He said, I should have done a little more research. Charlie Cook never said what I claimed he said.
Yeah,
and it was something pretty horrific,
yeah.
which I don't need to repeat. So, you know, I think that you have growth here, a little bit here and there. You've got some liberals that you would never in the world, some influential liberals, that never in the world would you ever expect that they would show some sort of concern.
I think he was forced to do that.
Oh, Stephen King?
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Because they were allowed to say just about anything during COVID.
Yeah, that's true.
So this is, again, I'm going to come back to this is, you know, because the apparatus was behind this, they are staging the whole aftermath of his death. And the liberals who are influential, like Stephen King, you know, he was allowed to say pretty nasty shit about those of us who didn't get, you know, vaccines. He was pretty nasty about the whole COVID thing, about people not wearing masks and all that. But when it came down to this, he thought it was like, you know, business as usual. I'm a liberal. I get to say my liberal thing.
I get to say whatever I want.
And he retracted it because he had his wrist slapped by either his publisher
or
by, you know, the agents of the state.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, he got the call.
Right.
It's like, yeah, you're allowed to do pretty much anything you want except on this one.
On this one,
and so you're going to have to retract this one.
So let's talk. Let's segue that.
And why did the New York Times just go and gloss over it? And why did all the media just kind of gloss over
it? Gloss over the assassination itself?
Well, just kind of like, no, him. Like, they didn't go after him.
Stephen King?
No, Charlie Kirk.
Oh.
They painted him as it was kind of blasé.
Oh, the New York Times did a piece that was so banal and
right.
so beige.
That's
like,
what I'm
yeah,
saying.
He wasn't really controversial. He was just a moderate.
Right.
He kind of hung out on college campuses. Don't really have much to say about it.
The Wikipedia entry is a little bit more harsh than that, but not by much.
Not by much, exactly. So,
and normally they would like call him a fucking racist or whatever.
Right. So let's talk about that and how that ties into, you know, and the Stephen King thing. Let's
mm-hmm.
talk about these three things. Why do you think the person who wrote the piece in the New York Times kept it very light and easy? And why do you think Wikipedia kept it somewhat light and easy? And why do you think Stephen King, you just said why you thought Stephen King had to retract his statement, because you believe that the apparatus was like, yeah, you can do whatever you want, but not on this case, slapped his hand and said, you got to remove it and apologize. And he did. This is all happening, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is all happening at the same time that a list is being created
right.
of 20,000 people who've gone on, allegedly 20,000 people, I haven't gone through all the names, but I've seen the list, 20,000 users, whether those users are real or not remains to be seen. They could just be personas created on social media that have come out and said some very appalling, horrific
mm-hmm.
things about the assassination, and some of those people have been fired from their jobs. And so the argument is, on the one hand, you have, look, if you believe in free speech, then you should be able to say things without consequence. Yet you have the New York Times writer really editing their
mm-hmm.
piece about him and keeping it soft.
Right.
You have the people who manage Wikipedia entries also keeping it soft. You have plenty of influencers who are keeping it really easy. Stephen
mm-hmm.
King retracting his point. So clearly there's a message here.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't about free speech.
No.
There is no free speech
no.
anymore.
But the people who believe in it and the Constitution and all that, like what, you know, Charlie Kirk was a constitutionalist or he believed strongly in the Constitution. And the people who are coming out and saying, you know, yeah, you know, free speech, the corporations have the right because of free speech to fire these people for saying what they said. But that flies in the face of free speech in the first place.
Right.
Right. You should be allowed to say what you want to say without retribution. Yes, you are allowed to be criticized. Other people can criticize you for that, but you shouldn't have your livelihood taken away as a result.
Right. So
right?
This goes back into the McCarthy era.
Yeah.
Where there was, you know, knocks on the doors of various actors and artists
who were
basically being accused of communists.
Right.
And having their livelihoods taken away. This
mm-hmm.
goes back to, you mentioned another incident.
I was talking about Richard Nixon's list of here's why Nixon and Trump are sort of similar.
Right.
They keep lists of their enemies. So he had an enemies list, and they were in the case of Nixon, they were his journalists. They were journalists that criticized him.
You know what? This is exactly the same thing as that. This is exactly the same thing. I think even Trump has come out and said openly that he has a list of media brands that
mm-hmm.
you know
yeah.
that he's going after.
Yeah.
So there is no difference. There's a lot of people who are old enough to like have lived through the Nixon era and
mm-hmm.
seen all this, and so they're like, yeah, this is just a same playbook out of that. So you're totally right. And I just made the quip, you know, the simple quip on Twitter. You know, I'm just against lists in
mm-hmm.
general.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just against lists in
yeah.
general. I'm
yeah.
not advocating for what these people did or said or what
right.
they allegedly did or said. Because I think of the alleged 20,000, I would say probably about 15,000 of them are probably fake accounts.
Right, yeah. I would agree with you.
Meant to...
Gin things up.
Gin things up and meant to have people go, well, fuck free speech. I want these assholes fired for saying this thing. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, okay. Well, you know, it works both ways.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this whole thing reminds me of, I mean, the way that everybody has gone lockstep into the messaging around, you know, like, you know, their tributes to him. Mm-hmm. Like, why Stephen King had to back off. And he wasn't fired. He was his wrist was slapped and
yeah, you don't fire someone like that.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but it reminds me of when COVID was taking place and Black Lives Matter was like at the forefront, right? That was the you know, mm-hmm. the thing to pay attention to during COVID for like 2 months, right? Mm-hmm. And all the corporate websites suddenly had messaging around white supremacy.
Mm-hmm. Every single
you
one.
You never saw that anywhere before.
Right.
And then it went away just as fast.
Our cell phone
and you
service.
Still don't, you still don't hear about it. I know, right?
So Walmart, Target, our cell phone service.
IKEA.
Corporate,
even the agency.
Crate and Barrel, like.
Even like the placement agency that I was working with from time to time had a message like that.
Yeah. So all of these, like, you know, companies.
Like, does a corporation give a fuck?
I think we just sat down one day. This is when we were still living in the P-town, which will not be named. Pittsburgh. I just named it. Where we actually sat down and we went through. Like, we're like, okay, let's try this one. Whoop, there it is. You know,
right.
And we found, like, all of these. It was like you would go to the website. And before you could even go to, like, a product page or the about page of the company,
right,
you got this flash that popped up first that says, we stand with Black Lives Matter. All are treated equal. And it was just this very...
Or it was like, we say something about white supremacy.
And it was a black background with white lettering on every single one.
Right.
And that is such a... That screams propaganda.
Yeah, with a centralized messaging.
Yeah.
Right?
You know.
So this feels centralized as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
The apparatus. That's why I use the word apparatus, because it's just like centralized.
Right. You know.
And you said something about there was some messaging going out there. Oh, that like all of a sudden actors and other people with money were coming out and saying they were going to donate. And it was like the same language over and over again.
Same exact language. And it was J. Cal from the All In podcast had the exact same tweet, the exact same language. I want to say various, I'd have to find it, but it was like various rock stars, you know, I want to say like Bon Jovi, you know, just all these like maybe Metallica, I don't know, but like all these rock stars, there were like six of them.
Wow.
And it was the exact same language. It wasn't even a little bit different, so it was clearly AI.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they're like, did we do that? Like, okay, I guess we did. But basically it was like, you know, we will take care of Erica. We're going to donate $1 million.
Right.
We're going to take care of Erica.
Which she doesn't need. And
which she doesn't even need.
We won't even be able to verify in the future whether they do it or not. So
exactly.
It's a very empty messaging,
right? It's a total empty.
But here's what I wonder.
Empty gift, right?
J. Cal's a liberal.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if these other celebrities were also on the liberal side and that this is
probably
sort of like a way of like deflecting.
Oh, sure.
You know.
We saw this with Black Lives Matter too.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, you know, outside of coffee shops, it's like, we love Black Lives Matter, which was basically a statement that said, please don't break our windows like you did in Minneapolis with the Starbucks.
Yeah, please don't burn my cafe.
Please don't burn my livelihood down.
Well, and then the whole thing with like Starbucks got really weird too. I mean, they got really weird. Starbucks did.
Yeah.
You know.
So we have a lot of different things going on, but then there's this really dark, overarching message, which I think started when the national emergency was declared on March 13th of 2020. And it's something that Allison McDowell and a little bit Julianne Romanello, these are a couple of influencers who looked at specific data points regarding the COVID operation. And sort of brought in a different kind of analysis regarding a new branding of way the economy is run. And it's all based on, and then, you know, let me interrupt myself. And then you couple in a giant book that was written by like a CIA operative who taught at Harvard. Her name is Shoshana Zuboff, where she talked about how
That was a doorstop.
We're the cadaver state now. Like, we no longer have. She called it. What was the book called? Something Capitalism.
What was that book?
It was called.
Because we were listening to her speak, like, in these different videos, like, before, right before COVID happened.
The Age of Surveillance Capitalism.
Yeah, Surveillance Capitalism.
I think it was even more than that.
Yeah, because she used a phrase that was basically like, you are the product, or you are what they're mining.
Right, so you are the, basically, your thoughts, your body, your choices, your passions, your belief systems, your worldviews, your humanity, whether you're a constitutionalist or whether you're just, you know, whatever, all of that is mined for profit. So what we're looking at is what I call the Frankenstein era, where the story of Frankenstein is that the doctor put together, like, am I right about this? The doctor put together a bunch of different body parts to create a new, stronger monster, right?
And he called it a monster. I think he was referred to as a monster, but I forget. It's been so long since I read that book.
The book in Stone Harbor a couple years back.
A used copy. I'd like to go back and read it. I read it probably 30 years ago, so it's been a while.
Three women, McDowell, Romanello, and who are less known than Shoshana Zuboff, who wrote The Age of Surveillance Capitalism, they all come back to one central point, which is the ransacking of the human experience in the same way that maybe in Victorian times, once again, we go back to that Victorian era type of behavior where people were so poor that they had to dig up graves and loot the bodies,
right? Well,
you know, in case someone was buried with jewelry or had a gold tooth, right, or a silver tooth. You know what I mean?
Prior to the Industrial Revolution, you know, we just watched like two productions that were based around that period of time, from like, say, you know, 1811 through 1830.
Okay, right.
And they were about how, you know, this was the sort of culmination of the Age of Reason, and even the book that you've been reading,
right? The Difference Engine
kind of encompasses that, where you have the surgeons. So they're, you know, like, they're called different names, but like in the one story we were reading, it took place at the same time as like, just like post Frankenstein. Mary Shelley was even a character in the production. Right.
Right.
And
exactly.
So the stories that were going on, or the thing was, is that, you know, bodies were being dug up right after burial for the medical students or the medical schools, so that they could use them as cadavers. There was even a law that was being, you know, like, thought about, passed in Parliament. This is an English story where, you know, all bodies could be, Or it was the poor people could be dug up. You know, the wealthy, no, you don't touch the wealthy, but you can dig up poor people. And the problem that people were having with that was, is it's like, yeah, well, before it was criminals and suicides of the unknown that you were using, but now you can dig up poor people, you know?
That's really interesting.
Right.
In Catherine Watt's historical account of chemical, biological, and neurological prophylactics, you know, going all the way back to the early 1900s, these types of agents, these types of substances were only done to the military. And when she said that, I immediately paused and thought, okay, why would that be? Why would you only, you know, force the military to take chemical, biological, and neurological agents? Probably because you knew they were going to die anyway.
Also, there, you know, yeah. a lot of people, a lot of men who were volunteering for the military outside of, you know, wartime that were like, you know, being patriotic,
yeah,
were usually poor people because they wanted to get out of you know, the life that they were living. I mean, we've heard stories
from
neighbors and like, you know, this is Mississippi. So like the story goes, and I'll just briefly, you know, just to illustrate this idea, mm-hmm. because I think that that's a prominent thing throughout the history of the United States. The men who volunteered outside of the war times were of poor. And this goes all the way through Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. And today too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Of course.
But like this was, his father. So we're talking World War II generation.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Depression, he left the family farm to join the military because the family was so poor that the children were the ones pulling the plow, not an animal.
Right.
And he was like, I'm done with this. And he left and joined the military.
Yeah. Okay.
That's how dire, like, things that life were. The things were, right?
Life was pretty bad.
So
starving and forcing children to work. Like,
well, because they didn't have an animal.
They
couldn't even afford. Yeah, exactly. They couldn't afford a horse or
let alone machinery.
Well, right. You know? Exactly.
So I get it. Yeah. So I just wanted to throw that in there as well. So you are... Let's go back to what you were just talking about, if we haven't got off
track. We got off track quite a bit, but
too
much. Okay.
But so we were talking about how we're in this age of what I call the Frankenstein era,
uh-huh.
where because there's no more capitalism and no more... It used to be that you could have a lot of local businesses, like in a small town like where we live,
mm-hmm.
that could support the economy and give back to the economy, and it would be a rotating economy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That is no more. It no longer matters if these small businesses stay afloat or not, because we have this Frankenstein economy where you've got NGOs, nonprofits, wraparound services,
you've got the foundations.
Foundations that all benefit wildly and hugely from turning us, their farm animals, into some kind of profit-wielding tool.
Right.
And it doesn't matter if we benefit from that. So it used to be that with capitalism, it's like, oh man, we can't let these people be slaves anymore. Now we have to pay them. Fine, mm-hmm. we'll give them a minimum wage and everyone will be happy.
Right.
Whatever. But we'll still
And they'll buy things that we make and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, they'll buy the things we make and turn it right back into our pockets. Okay. Now what they're saying is, well, fuck those people. Why should we pay them?
Mm-hmm.
Let's slap some debt on them. Let's slap some wraparound services on them. Let's force them into poverty and make them take welfare checks and make them get on food stamps. How dare they want to grow their own food? How dare they want to contribute to the small businesses? Because all of that I just mentioned, growing your own food, running your own companies, opening up that cafe, opening up that shop, the apparatus or the powers that be are like, that's money being taken away from us. Mm-hmm. How dare you run your own gardening business?
So now, you know, the money comes down, you know, through the government, into the foundations, into the, you know, the organizations that run the wraparound services that keep people on the hook. So for instance, like, you know, like the United Way is a good example where they would mm-hmm. set up wraparound services in a community. And, you know, part of the reason that they exist is so they can start collecting data on the people who they are supposedly serving.
Right.
Now, the services they provide only keep people, you know, busy enough to where they won't get a new job or they won't get employment, but it keeps them on the dole. It keeps them in places of poverty.
That's the Frankensteinian effect that I talk about, where you've got to chop a person up, get rid of the heart and soul of what makes them human, and just force them into this place of depravity, where they're just, you know, just trying to breathe and eat.
Yeah, and people, and ordinary people be like, well, that doesn't sound like, you know, like, how do they make money? Well, it's like, it's not about necessarily making money directly. It's about collecting data so that they can use it in other ways and sell it and trade it.
The person who is the Dr. Frankenstein of our modern day life right now is Peter Thiel. Mm-hmm. He personally funded, out of his own pocket, J.D. Vance's campaign. Mm-hmm. There were lavish parties that Trump attended in San Francisco at David Sachs's, who is now at David Sachs's home in San Francisco, and David Sachs, of course, now being the
AI czar,
yeah, or something like that, and in the Trump administration. So this is a Frankenstein moment that we're in, mm-hmm. and that's why I think the earlier individuals who talked about this, the McDowells and the Romanellos and the Zuboffs out there, interestingly enough, they were all women, because women have a sense about these things. Mm. That's why they sort of felt like they were screaming into the void, mm-hmm. because this moment that we're in right now, where we're watching a cadaver be turned into a profit-making machine, mm-hmm. and to push an agenda and to push this sort of godlike, megalomaniacal attitude about, like, you know, I will take over the world with Turning Point and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. That's exactly the same kind of effect you had with Dr. Frankenstein. He was this crazed, you know, doctor in his lab going, I can play God, you know, and all this. That's what you have with this story of the Kirk assassination.
Yeah.
Like, to bring it back down to one of the reasons we're doing this in the first place. So, you know, it's going to be really difficult to survive as a human being, mm-hmm. when you are just lobbed with and constantly assaulted with, you know, stupid ass propaganda, like, oh, he was a trans leftist, and who did it? No, it was just, you know, that's just the story, right, to get you distracted from the fact that your government has zero consideration for you.
Right.
Prior to 2020, you were somebody that they tolerated, mm-hmm. and that they were like, fine, we'll pay them a quasi-living wage and whatever. Now they're just like, well, why do we have to do that?
Right.
Yeah. Why do we have to do that? If you breathe, the government is like, or the state or the apparatus is basically like, you're breathing? That's my oxygen. How dare you? Mm-hmm. Well, that's how they feel about it.
You know, and
now,
I think if you, you know, like, the reason I use the word apparatus, because it's not any one thing, like any one entity. It's like the government and corporations and, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. else, right?
And nonprofits.
The NGOs and foundations and stuff, right?
Right.
And so they all work, you know, together.
The military.
The military. Yeah. And so, you know, all these things are, you know, entwined, mm-hmm. you know, to put out these initiatives that keep us busy or that keep us on the hook or that, you know, whatever. And it's like, you know, we've been talking about the mundane for years, and that debt is part of how money is being made now.
Right.
It's putting people into debt that is driving the economy.
Right.
It's taking, you know, they're not kicking down doors and taking names. They're forcing you into wraparound services and taking names. They're collecting data from your children, the essential information about you and your children, your health,
right,
and your
that's why
your
it's
economic...
absolutely crucial at this point, no matter what, to get the fuck off social media.
Yeah, but see, the thing is
that's the biggest data,
collection
out there.
Right, but then they're, you know, they're doing these other things too, where it's like, you know, if you go on unemployment or so when you're on unemployment, they make you go through these hoops.
I
experienced this in Mississippi.
Which
like
is the most bizarre experience ever.
Right? They were flaming hoops. And you know, and they want you to go through these programs to, like, apply for jobs and do, like, because, you know, this organization was run by the state of Mississippi that I was, you know, engaging with, but forced to in order to get a check.
Right, in order to get your measly...
Right, and applying for jobs that didn't exist. Well, the reason... And they had specific jobs they wanted you to apply for.
Even if they were outside of your...
Right. So they had a list of jobs
You're a UX designer.
But you still had to apply for, you could only apply for specific jobs that were on the list of a certain number, right?
Right.
And that's because funding came through when you did those. And those jobs didn't even exist. Like, I applied for them thinking I'd get at least an interview, like, because they were pretty menial, mm-hmm. right? And I was like, well, I could probably do that, you know, paint walls at the local casino, right? I could probably do that. I got an email back saying that the job had been filled. Well, that job never existed in
right.
the first place.
And I found out just through the person who, like, does my highlights and stuff, that her daughter got a job at a casino because one of her ex-husband's mothers got her the job.
Right.
So it's clearly, in this town, it's clearly who you know.
Well, yeah, and I think that's the way
it
goes.
And we don't know anybody because we're from California.
That's the way it goes with anything. But,
right.
you know, but the point I'm trying to make is that This is what are known as wraparound services, and they are designed to keep you busy doing what they, you know, doing what you think you're doing, right? Mm-hmm. Looking for work legitimately.
But you're not.
But they're getting you to a point to where you just kind of get there, and then you don't get it, and you have to start over again. And you stay in this loop mm-hmm. of services, and mm-hmm. those services are paid for through foundation money, through government money, mm-hmm. and whatever. And then there's kickbacks and whatever, however the investments roll. Because this is all predicated or based on very complicated investment type of structures mm-hmm. that ordinary people don't quite understand. I don't even understand it.
Well,
okay?
You have a better sense of it than most people.
I can see it, but I
can
don't
see it too.
But I don't understand it.
Yeah. I mean,
and, you know,
I think that, look, it's literally a series of box checking.
Mm-hmm.
You want $25,000 for the Mississippi State of Unemployment? Great. Check this box. Sign up with these services. Mm-hmm. And this is a conversation that the government is having with the state of Mississippi mm-hmm. Unemployment Department.
Right.
Now, go find your cadavers to do all the running around.
Right.
And that's where you come in, and they say, well, because I checked this box and signed up with this service, you've got to go over to this company, this very specific company. And even though you're a UX designer and the only one in the state of Mississippi that does what you do, and you're extremely overqualified for, you know, mopping floors, we're going to have you go apply for that job anyway. That way we get our you know, our
exactly.
funding, and then we can then justify your $199 a week. Unemployment check.
Right. And you know, this has been, this type of bureaucracy.
I mean, to me, that makes total sense.
Sure.
Right?
And this type of bureaucracy has been going on for a long time, this sort of box checking in order to get funding. Because
right.
when I worked for the Small Business Development Center as a consultant, for every person that I saw, I had to fill out a form, and there were literal boxes that I had to check. And,
like, did they meet the certain criteria?
Right. And,
yeah.
you know, what did we do to serve them, and what was the outcome?
Right.
Right. Because we were funded through the SBC, and the SBC is a cabinet level
right.
Administration in the presidential, you know, in the country. Right.
Right?
So it's
right.
part of the executive branch of the government. Right?
Right.
And so you have this direct correlation between I have done, you know, this, I've had a conversation with this person who's running a business, and they needed these services, and for that we get X amount of funding
right.
for serving that person, blah blah blah. Now that's an old way of dealing with things. I don't know if they still do that.
They do, because what they've done is they've taken that
model,
what you just described, that very model, and now they've applied it to, if you're under a state of emergency,
mm-hmm.
have you met this particular type of criteria? Have you checked all of these boxes? Have you done everything that you can do to mitigate this emergency, whether it is a crime emergency, a health emergency, an environmental emergency, you see?
Right.
So we live under that framework, or that example that you used when you worked
for
the
system, yeah.
That system that you worked for the SBDC, the Small Business Development Center, they're taking that same model and they're applying it to these different emergency allocations. It's why currently the state we live in is under a state of emergency. The governor of Mississippi came out last month and declared that the state of Mississippi is under a health emergency. And the reason being is because they were able to calculate numbers mm-hmm. that stated, and I don't believe these numbers are true, but they needed to prove that they were true on paper mm-hmm. in order to qualify for the funding, mm-hmm. somehow came up with this idea that the state of Mississippi had the highest rate of infant deaths in the country, which meant that it opened them up to a funding stream from the emergency, from the federal emergency level.
Right.
And so then it says, okay, well, where is that funding stream going to go? Is it going to go to these little community hospitals? Is it going to go to midwives? Is it going to go to, you know, mothers who are pregnant? Because we really want to identify why we have the highest rate of infant deaths in the country. No, it went to one medical center, the University of Mississippi Medical Center, who has taken all of the funding, and they are now going to research and do experiments on and test pregnant mothers, saying in order to, you know, and so their bureaucracy is in order to continue to qualify for this funding so that we can pay for our medical services, so that we can pay our rent or our mortgage for our buildings, so that, you know, mm-hmm. we can pay our doctors and nurses on staff. We need pregnant mothers and children to come into our facility that we can take blood from and run tests
right, so
and
that,
check off all these boxes, hand it back to the federal government who supplies the funding stream and says, see, we've done our part, give us more money.
Right, and well, not only the blood, but like now you've got all this data
right, and
collected
here's all
on
the
these
data
people.
Collected
and
on...
I guarantee you that these are people...
Who are poor,
right.
Always, it's always the poor, because the wealthy can go to private... hospitals.
Right,
the
they
wealthy
have
insurance or money
right.
where they don't have to go into university systems that are typically free.
Well, and it's easy to blame poor people for, you know, like not going to the doctor during the time that they, you know, the pregnancy went on. I mean, we had a friend who didn't even realize that she was pregnant because of other, you know, for a lot of her different reasons. I'm not going to go into those. But she suddenly, like, experienced like abdominal pain, and they took her to the hospital, and it was like she had a baby,
right?
And she didn't even know it, and they were starting to.
The police came.
Yeah, they were starting to crank up the apparatus to basically put her into prison for negligence,
right?
And child, you
all
know.
Because she was poor and has a little bit of a mental disability,
right? And she was also under a lot of like trauma.
Right, she had come out of a very abusive relationship.
Right, and that so basically,
imagine
yeah.
not knowing what it is your body is going through, just knowing that you're feeling pain, but you don't know why.
Right.
And then waking up in the middle of the night, knocking on your mom's door and saying, I think I just wet the bed. I don't know what's happening. Right, being rushed to the hospital within the next hour or so, you're giving birth. The baby is whisked away from you. You have no idea what's going on. Next thing you know, the police show up at your bedside when you're in extreme pain. You don't know what's happening.
You're most vulnerable.
And they're telling you that you're going to go to jail because you didn't do all of the proper necessary things in order to make sure that you had a healthy birth. You didn't go to your wellness checks. You didn't take your vitamins. You didn't do all these things. And all of this is being told to her in front of her parents, who intervened, thank goodness, and said, whoa, well, you know, look, we don't know what happened. We don't know how this happened, but we're going to intervene and we'll take care of the baby. Like, thank God.
Right.
That's one thing I've noticed. This happened in Pittsburgh.
Right.
And this happened to a neighbor of ours. So that's one thing I've noticed about Pittsburgh, at least, is that there seems to be an extraordinary authoritarian, horrific apparatus in place that is tied to Child Protective Services and the police and all this, and that the families are aware of it. Like, every family is aware
yeah.
of this.
Enough to step in and try to
elbow them out of the way and say, no, we're intervening.
Right.
So this is, you know, this we heard of a couple of different
stories, scenarios like that.
Situations like this. It was one of the most horrific stories I've ever heard. Coming from San Francisco, coming from a place where everybody mm-hmm. has this sort of privileged life. I didn't, but I was surrounded by people who did. And hearing this story, I'd always, you know, mm-hmm. I'd always been kept protected. From these types of stories.
Right.
Never, it was always something you heard about way, way over there. And then all of a sudden it was happening right in front of my eyes.
Yeah, right.
Like, I just couldn't believe it. So not only were they getting ready to arrest her and throw her in prison for potentially, you know, being abusive to this infant, right, to this newborn because of her lack of understanding of what it means to be pregnant, but also they were going to grab the child and throw them into protective services.
Right.
So the police would have got a little bonus for that. CPS would have got a bonus. Like, they took advantage of a very vulnerable, poor, uneducated situation. Even the parents are not very educated.
Right.
You know.
They knew enough to intervene.
They just knew, like, instinctively, I guess it was her mother that stepped in and was like, my mother's instinct is telling me that there's something wrong here.
Right.
This is now a child that is blood related to me.
Right.
I should have him,
right.
not the state.
Right.
So it like worked out, and we watched this kid grow up,
mm-hmm.
you know, and he's okay. I think he's got, you know, some issues, but that's only because of his environment.
Yeah.
I think he's like,
he's pretty bright otherwise.
He's really bright,
yeah.
and he's very strong. And I just feel bad because I think that if he was in a place like where we are,
mm-hmm.
where the kids are free and, mm-hmm. and educated and really smart and healthy,
mm-hmm.
I think that he would thrive,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, we got off topic again. But so back to, we're going to close.
But I think it kind of illustrates what we're trying to say.
Yeah,
you know, this, that they, it that, does. That we are being extracted. We as people are what they extract. And it doesn't matter if it's our biomedical information, our financial education, or sorry, information, our educational information, just everything about us is fed into, you know, these databases now,
mm-hmm.
which are used to control us or used to market to us. So, you know, this is why you get, you know, letters in the mail offering you, you know, personal loans. This is, you know, and that's the most what's the word I'm looking for? Like the most like banal or like the least
yeah.
of your worries,
that's
right?
That's the least of your worries, exactly.
But, you know, all this other data that's about you, you know, they you know, you always hear these horrific stories about identity theft. Well, that's nothing compared to what goes on, you know, now in the world, well, at least in the United States, right?
Mm-hmm.
As a U.S. citizen, you know, you are the most surveilled human on the planet.
Right. And it's normalized.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the problem, is that they create stories and they create, you know, what I call, you know, emotionally saturated amygdalas to suspend your understanding of what is so banal and so normal, which is what you just said. We're the most surveilled, but not just surveilled. It's one thing to be surveilled, but why?
Mm-hmm.
So that they can collect, so that they can take. You don't need that arm, so they'll take off your arm, and your arm is like your social media presence. Well, you don't need that leg. What's that leg? That leg represents your job security. You
mm-hmm.
don't need job security. You don't need to connect with people.
Right.
Like they rip apart your body and your essence for profit, and that's normal. That's a normal, like, everyday.
Mm-hmm.
This has now replaced the means of production supporting capitalism,
mm-hmm.
where your local economies
right.
give back to the individuals who pay the taxes in the economy so that they can keep their house. That is a concept that's so 20th century and so old school that a lot of people in the older generations, like Michael Savage, like baby movers, have no clue that's gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, they set fire to that and turned it into this new Frankenstein era. And I'm witnessing in this very over the top, like, colorful language displayed through the assassination of Charlie Kirk, I'm witnessing it in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is the story that they're telling you, that this body, once full of life, has now been picked apart
mm-hmm.
for various agendas. We're going to blame the left. We're going to turn Turning Point into a, you know, his company into this monster.
Yeah, this thing that it never was.
This religious monster.
We're going to be able to control its message. Because before its message was going against us, now we're going to make sure that it's supporting.
Support us, mm-hmm. Exactly. They saw some benefit to that. You know, it's, and what else are they're doing? They're bringing back this memento mori idea of memorializing dead bodies and using corpses, you know, propping up corpses to tell a message. And what does that say? That tells me that there's a lot of personas. There's a lot of non-people mm-hmm. out there on social media, mm-hmm. users that are AI generated. Irina something or other from Ukraine, who allegedly got right. stabbed or sliced and diced on the Charlotte train. That is memento mori in action. That right. is not a real story.
Right.
That is using a persona to create a cadaver to invest in a concept. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is Frankenstein.
Well, and it
like
it,
these are modernized.
Yeah, and these are used in different ways for different agendas, and I think that it ties into the whole idea of the Trump administration wanting to put the National Guard out in various cities mm-hmm. in the United States because crime.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I have to at least, you know, applaud the New York Times for pointing out that, you know, Trump wanting to put the National Guard into D.C. and taking over the D.C. police, claiming that crime was at an all-time high. They're like, no, it isn't. It's not at an all-time high. Mm-hmm. And the kind of crime that actually is going on is the kind of crime that, you know, we're facing on the regular, like fraud.
Like what we're talking about.
Like being fraud. Defrauded and these other things that are going on, like, you know, the data collection and
right. These things that violate your human autonomous existence.
Right. No, the crime that was going on in Washington, D.C. was Doge kicking down the door
right.
and breaking into the Social Security databases and scraping information.
And handing it over to Peter Thiel, who, like I just said, is the Frankenstein,
right. but they,
the Dr. Frankenstein.
But they made
story.
That normal and said, no, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay, right?
Yeah, it's okay,
that's
right?
That's such a very Silicon Valley response
it
to
is.
Everything.
Yeah.
It's okay, right?
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
I can yell at you because, you know, you're walking across the street the wrong way. It's okay, right? But you can't respond to me when I do that.
Right. And so,
you know,
right.
So
all these, like, these scenarios are being put out there, and because they can generate them and spin them up and put them into the media, they can use these as justifying policies and other things. And this has been going on for a while. This isn't just the Trump administration.
Right.
Obama did it.
Right.
You know, the W. Bush administration did it. And, you know, this has been going on for a long time. So it's nothing new. It's just that it gets worse and worse with every cycle.
Yeah, it does. And so it transitions from, okay, so we'll end with you know, these last couple of comments, because it's been, you know, a long...
Yeah,
you know,
how long have we been talking?
A long talk. I guess about an hour.
Yeah. A little over.
But
hour and a half.
Okay, so we have right now, you know, liberals in general saying, you know, we have to get rid of this fascist dictator. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I apply fascism with, you know... I need you to bind your mouth when you get on a public bus, or I need you to put on a mask if you need to get some eye drops from Walgreens. I was applying fascism in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like anything that forces you to do a thing that you would never do
mm-hmm.
in your human state, like stick out your arm and get filled with chemical, biological, and neurological prophylactics, also known as vaccines, that have never been tested, and they even came out and said, yeah, we didn't test them. That's fascism if you have to do that in order to keep your job.
Mm-hmm.
But the liberals never applied that
Mm-mm.
that type
they,
of...
They like to go to the Hitler thing, which
yeah.
is different.
And what I'm saying is we are so beyond fascism.
Right.
We are now in medieval times. We are now like the equivalent of the space where poor people's heads are being put on the guillotine. Because they said a thing, because mm-hmm. they spoke out against the state. We are now in this Frankenstein place where, you know, our thoughts and bodies, even our bodies, are being experimented on. And then not only that, we're even beyond that, because like Julianne Romanello was trying to say all those years ago, I'm sick of the necromancy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand at the time why she kept using that term.
Yeah, I didn't quite get it.
But now I see the love of the destructive forces that have taken place post-COVID shot and post-COVID, right? The love, like the absolute, like love of people being sick, you know?
Yeah.
The love of it. That's necromancy.
Right.
The love of death. The love of stroking cadavers in an affectionate manner.
And what's with all this, like, there's a trend right now of gothic horror.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back. And
there's a reason for that.
There's
three movies that are all Frankenstein related. The Bride, and then Frankenstein, and then another one. There's like three, maybe even four movies that are coming out that or have already come out within the last month.
The Corpse Bride.
Corpse Bride is coming back. And then there's another.
The Bride, which is the Bride of Frankenstein.
And then The Bride that Maggie Gyllenhaal is doing.
And then Frankenstein.
And then Frankenstein.
Oh, and then there's a Dracula one,
right,
too.
And then Dracula is coming. So all of this has to do with necromancy. All of this has to do with this gothic, you know, obsession and love of death and darkness. And so that's why earlier today, before we hit record, I was like, I feel like we're in the dark ages now. And you're like, I feel like that, you know.
So here's the thing, the difference between the medieval times and what you're referring to is, I think what we're referring to and what we keep coming back to, and that's like Victorian times and, you know, this, like what we're talking about with, like, you know, digging up bodies for,
mm-hmm.
you know,
grave robbing.
This is post Enlightenment. So the Enlightenment is what brought about a lot of the things that caused that you know, Mary Shelley was talking about. You know, the sciences emerging,
mm-hmm.
and science being used as a means to justify
playing God.
Yeah, because what they, you know, what they used was, and what they still use to this day, is, well, this is science, and we don't believe in, you know, fantasy and magic and things like that. Whereas magic and ritual, like real ritual, like authentic ritual, is part of the Middle Ages, is part of the medieval times, because it was pre-modern. You know, modernism came about as a result of the Enlightenment, and modernism is what has separated us from nature,
right?
And is what has separated us from true human spirituality and its relationship with the world, as opposed to a very materialistic world, but also a dominant monotheistic point of view, where it's like it's God the Father,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to us being people and natural, and even if we are of a monotheistic faith, that relationship with God is much different back then than it is today.
Right.
Okay. It's a lot more authoritarian now.
And exploitive.
Right. And yeah. I think modernism has brought that about. In fact, yeah. modernism has gone out of its way to try to extract God
mm-hmm.
from our life.
Right.
Whether, however you identify, or however identify put into, you know, whatever manifestation, however you look at God, whatever that might be.
Yeah, whatever religion you choose,
right.
or whatever worldview you have about God.
Exactly.
Or whatever, yeah.
Because the mystical and the spiritual has no place in the modern world.
Mm-mm.
And what is interesting about what's going on with, like, the Charlie Kirk thing and this whole, like, you know, the Christian you know, the right, the conservative,
born again,
the born again, the conservative Christians, is, I've always found it a very weird way of having a relationship with God, and it's very you know, this is my criticism of it, this is my opinion, so you know, whatever, you can take from this what you want. But I feel like, and I don't know exactly what connections I'm trying to make, but it just feels like it's taking us back into, like, it has allowed his death and this whole thing with this, the apparatus taking over his organization, so that it falls in line with what they're trying to say, is it's the same exploitation that the conservative parties have used against, or used to control the Christian right for the last 40 years. So yeah, that's basically the connection I'm trying to make. I'm sorry. I'm still like formulating it as we speak, but it's very, and I'm sorry we're ending on kind of a, you know,
apologize. But it's all fine.
But this gothic sense of mm-hmm. mortality and the Frankenstein era that you're describing mm-hmm. is a modern phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And by modern, I mean modernity goes back to the end of the 17th century.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
it's so interesting how it correlates with all of the different laws and articles that were passed in Congress starting from that time frame that you
The Enlightenment brought mm-hmm. about the American Revolution.
Right. So I think that, you know, so what happens when you have, you mentioned something that was really salient. Modern religions have really taken out the mystical and really taken out the sort of these things that we were born with, which is instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And that modern religion seems to really just pound those out of us and replace it with authoritarian God the Father rule. The problem with that is it's like whack-a-mole. When you pound something out and mm-hmm. you pound it out mm-hmm. and you get it to go away, guaranteed three more will pop up even stronger than before. Mm-hmm. So I feel that in our personal life and in our private life, especially over the last 6 years since we've had two cross-country moves mm-hmm. in that span, which is pretty radical for two people who stayed in one place for decades.
Yeah, and I'm a homebody.
Yeah. I think that this whole experience, you know, has, we popped up and are living in pure instinct now. Mm-hmm. We are literally, you know, every single day of our life when we feel like we need to go one direction,
mm-hmm.
we pause, listen to our instincts, check in with our, you know, spirit guides or whatever. Yeah. We do like a rune cast. We talk to each other. We formulate, you know, different scenarios of what could happen if we went this direction or this direction or that direction. And ultimately, we leave it up to our instinct. And a lot of times, life is dictated by what you don't do. Mm-hmm. Life is dictated by sitting on your hands, watching quietly, and when it's the right time is when you make that move. That's pure instinct. Mm-hmm. That goes against religion, a religious philosophy of authoritarianism, mm-hmm. where you have to follow the rules and all this.
Right.
All of the rules that have been played out for us have been used to hurt us, it right. feels like. So when they try to whack that instinct
mm-hmm.
out of people, that thing that says, you know, I'm not so sure an untested chemical, biological, and neurological prophylactic should be surging through my body. That's the instinct.
Right.
And then you've got the propaganda to pound that instinct out of you. You've got your own, you know, employer saying, if you don't do this, you're fired. You right. know, so all the fear and all the language makes you go, okay, well, I'm going to just ignore my instinct and do it anyway. And, you know, so when you have a situation like that, and you have a situation like what happened with Charlie Kirk, the assassination itself, I've noticed a lot of people are in a bewildered state. This isn't real. This can't be real. This has to be fake. I'm having a hard time, you know, grappling with this. Like, I can't believe, like, they're totally disillusioned from it. And that's because everything that they've seen up until this point, all the violence that they've seen up until this point in their lives has been curated, has been anything from CGI to AI to simple propaganda to, and it's just been words and words and fake videos and fake personas and wall-eyed models from Ukraine that aren't even real. Like, all of this stuff was saturating their emotions, and they were getting angry at nothing that was there. Right. There was no there, and they were getting angry at it, and their instinct told them that, but they ignored their instinct. So then when they saw something that was really real, they fell apart. They were like, what did I just see? Mm-hmm. Well, you saw the real.
Mm-hmm.
For years, they've been pummeling you with bullshit, even planes driving into buildings, right, which were CGI, obviously. Like, they have been pummeling you with fake imagery and staged hysteria for so long that when you see something real, you can't even fathom it. And right. I had been warning people about this for 20 years. Mm-hmm. All the things that you're seeing, your life is a series of 9/11 moments, which was a phrase that I coined, which some people still share to this day on their social media pages.
Yeah.
Your life is a series of 9/11 moments. What does that mean? It means that your life is a series of fake outrage, fake hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
You know, manipulated events that aren't even based in reality, but have serious consequences. And the Patriot Act, right, and the NDAA was all serious consequences. Being molested at the airport, serious consequences, serious invasions of your body autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept saying, your life is a series of 9/11s. Which is a chipping away at your body autonomy and your rights to live as a human, so that when you do see the real thing, it's going to shatter you. And that's exactly where we are.
Yeah.
That we saw the real thing. It was a real assassination. There is no doubt in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 5 years from now, forensics will discover, just like we discovered with 9/11, a lot of people woke up finally, but it took 20 years to do so, that the forensics just did not match the story.
Right.
You know?
Well,
so
the
maybe
fact that there was no fuselage at the Pentagon.
I know, right.
Or at the 9/11.
Anywhere.
In New York, yeah.
So maybe we'll discover that, you know, something else happened and that they disappeared him some other way. But I think they took him out.
Yeah.
They took him out.
Look, Julie, all the furniture is burned up. But look here, I found a passport.
I found a passport. You know, so maybe with Kirk, it's like, you know, in 5 years from now or 10 years from now or 20 years from now, there will be some sort of forensic analysis that will indicate that he didn't really die or something. But I don't think so. You know, it's just like with BT, with Brian Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
They took him out. Okay, now they staged the way he was taken out, but they took him out. They probably poisoned him. I think they just poisoned him and gave him a heart attack and then, you know, let his body just kind of hang out somewhere. And then they just they probably took an old video of him walking in Manhattan because he's a VP of a major.
He was more than a VP.
Oh, that's right.
He was CEO of the insurance.
Right. So how many trips to Manhattan has he taken?
Right.
So they found some really good footage of him, you know, probably from 5 years ago in a blue suit walking into a building,
mm-hmm.
you know, claimed that that was the meeting he was at that day.
Right. You can manipulate anything.
You can do anything, right? But I don't. But you can't with this.
It looks
with
too.
This
yeah.
one on September 10th, 2025.
It did not look like stagecraft.
It was not stagecraft. It really happened. It really happened. And then what's surrounding it, the story that's surrounding it, is the stagecraft.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The little girl did not run across the field and say, I'm scared of a bad noise, let me run to daddy. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
That is meant to tap into your sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
Sentimentality and vulnerability are the best ways to manipulate people. So that didn't happen. Turning Point certainly used this event to turn their to turn that platform into a platform that would operate for the establishment or for the apparatus instead of against it. Now, you know, you've got two major presidential candidates that felt threatened by Charlie Kirk. Governor Newsom and J.D. Vance are now scot-free. They can pit against each other and don't have to worry about the dark horse that could have upset them both, Charlie Kirk. You know, so you've got all of these other things in play that are meaningful, and, you know, the story of it being a leftist or, you know, a random patsy, people are, you know, following that breadcrumb and going down that avenue. So all of the language around the actual assassination is storytelling,
right?
So, which is an odd thing, because usually it's the actual event that is the story.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
A lot of events, a lot of stories from 9/11 to some elementary school in Connecticut, which I won't mention.
Or Las Vegas, even.
And Las Vegas. Right. And all of that was storytelling. But so that's what makes this so different, and that's why people are kind of falling apart and they're going through the typical range of emotions. Mm-hmm. First is deep grief, then denial. No, first I think was denial. I don't know what the range of emotions are when it comes to death, but I know that denial was in there, and then deep grief.
Anger.
And now is anger and revenge. Mm-hmm. And that's why they created a list of social media accounts that were allegedly celebrating his assassination, and they want to go after those people and get them fired.
Yeah, that's almost like a relief valve.
It's a relief valve. It's, you know, and then the next thing will come acceptance. And with acceptance will come, you know, some sort of peace. And then after that, you know what I'm saying? There's always this, these places where we go when grief is involved. And it's fast, because today's the 13th and it only happened on the 10th.
Right.
Usually it takes like a couple of weeks to go through denial.
The news cycle is driving this, and the news cycle is very fast.
Because we are manipulated by social media, not even the news cycle anymore.
Right. Yeah,
we are manipulated by like a flood of bots, a flood of propaganda agents, and a flood of psychological agents. That somebody said recently that social media is no longer actual users, like the majority of the people on social media are no longer actual users, actual, you know, flesh and bone human beings, but they're just bots or they're agents manipulating.
Right.
So
right.
The news manipulating people, I don't think that's a thing anymore. I think it's your LinkedIn page. I think it's your Facebook page. I think it's your Twitter page.
Mm-hmm.
It's your Instagram reels. It's your TikTok reels that are influencing people. The news is...
Yeah.
It doesn't influence.
It doesn't.
Anymore.
It only supports, right?
Yeah. And so as a result of that influence, the process by which we go through those steps of when somebody dies is accelerated, like you just said. So it used to be without social media and somebody died and it was tragic. Like, for instance, with JFK, it took the nation a couple of weeks or even a month to process one emotion, which was denial. So for a whole month, the nation was in denial. And finally, when they accepted it, another month, they grieved. And it took like a year for people to really kind of get back to normal.
People to this day, you know where they were when that happened.
Exactly. And that was because they didn't have social media influencing and kicking up and accelerating their emotional responses to these things. So anyway, we're going to stop here. Mm-hmm. Is there anything more you want to say?
No.
No.
I mean, there's some thoughts that I've had that kind of are peripheral to this whole thing, but I don't know if I really...
Yeah. I mean, we can always do a part two, but this is a lot of information packed.
Yeah.
So we'll go ahead and end it. Thank you, everybody, for joining. This is almost 2 hours. This is this would be like a bookmark.
Yeah.
This is a Saturday bookmarks is what we used to do, where we would spend about an hour and a half once a month or so.
Yeah.
Just kind of breaking down what's going on in the world. And we have had some patrons and even some friends say, I think this would be a good time for you guys to do some kind of a bookmark or have some sort of commentary around this, because there's a lot of weird shit going down.
There is, yeah.
And we need Book of Hours to kind of, you know, break it apart for us.
Yeah.
So that's what this is about. So you're welcome and thank you, and we'll see you again.
Thanks.
Bye.